This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We probably don't need to tell you it's cold this morning. Dangerously cold to be outside for just about any length of time. The latest conditions and forecast can be found at WUWM.com/weather. The high temperature today is expected to reach 9 or 10 below. Schools are closed around Milwaukee to keep children from having to spend time in the extreme cold. But some people will need to be outside today. And in doing so, they risk some significant health issues. Dr. Chris Decker is Emergency Department Medical Director at Frater and the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's with us by phone to talk about those issues. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What are the primary dangers to people from extremely cold temperatures?
Well, the most common danger is really freezing of the skin or frostbite.
Frostbite's one of those terms that people throw around kind of casually, I think. You know, people say, it's so cold, I almost got frostbite the other day, and that may or may not be the case. But explain, what happens in true frostbite situations?
So frostbite is really a form of a burn or skin death. So in the worst circumstances, the skin freezes and then actually dies and then sloughs off and then you're left with a scar. The most common type of frostbite is frost nip, or first-degree frostbite, where the skin gets cold, it gets numb, you recognize it gets numb, so you go inside, and then as it rewarms, you feel the tingling or some mild pain as things go back to normal.
Well, what are the temperatures we're talking about, and what's the length of exposure that one needs to start being concerned about?
You know, everybody wants to know that, and I think, obviously, over the weekend, we're really talking, you know, I don't know the exact time, but we're talking within a few minutes, you could get frostbite on the tips of your fingers, your nose, and your ears, and your toes if they're exposed to the cold wind. But really, I like to talk about, you want to make sure that you stay dry, that you keep the wind off your back, and that you keep your head, hands, and feet warm and stay well hydrated. That's really how you prevent frostbite.
The other term that gets used often but probably imprecisely is just the general blanket term exposure. What are the risks of exposure, and what are we talking about?
So when I say exposure, I mean skin to the cold air. So if you can keep your skin out of the cold air, you're protecting yourself. If you can give it thermal protection, meaning keep it warm, you're protecting yourself. And if you can keep wind off it, you're giving yourself more protection.
Well, and that's a good point. I mean, are there aspects to dressing appropriately for extreme cold that maybe we overlook?
I think most people in this kind of weather will they'll underdress. So the critical issue is really, if you want to protect frostbite risk areas that get frostbitten, you want to make sure your ears are protected, you want to make sure your fingers are protected, you want to make sure your nose is protected, and your toes. Ideally, if you cover your head and feet, you have a good chance of not getting frostbitten.
Well, and you mentioned the idea of frostbite coming in degrees, and the first degree frostbite or frost nip is this kind of standard, you know, we get cold and so we go inside and we feel our skin warming up and maybe it tingles, maybe it burns a little bit. What's the point at which we should be concerned about doing some serious damage? When does it become second or third degree frostbite?
So it comes when you don't take the signals in your body that you should go inside. So if you feel numbness in the fingertips, on the cheeks, on the nose, on the ear, those are signals that you need to get out of temperatures that you're in and get to a warm environment. If you neglect those signals, and meaning you choose to do that, you might be skiing, you might be away from warm areas, you might be drinking and neglect those, you might, mostly those are the high-risk areas. If you neglect those signals to your body, then you run the risk of beginning to freeze that skin. If you're out for a length of time, and here this could, you know, you're talking about 30 or 40 minutes of time, you're really talking about the skin actually beginning to blister, much like a second degree burn. And then all of the things that come with blistering, you get rupture of those blisters and you get scars, and then you have to manage those just like you manage wounds.
So that's frostbite. What about hypothermia? What are the risks of hypothermia?
Okay, a little bit different animal. So the hypothermia is about keeping your core warm. So you want the body, basically your trunk, which is really from your shoulders down to your hips. You want to keep that warm. That allows your body to keep the blood warm and circulate throughout the body. That way you can keep your temperature where it's supposed to be at 98.6.
And so in this case, this is not a question of having exposed skin, but this is more of a question of being dressed appropriately and staying dry?
Indeed. So exposed skin absolutely can contribute to hypothermia. So you want to recognize, you want to dress appropriately. You want to dress in layers that most people understand. And the one thing I've been sharing is that you actually want to wear wind protection. So if you have a winter jacket that has the wind cutting through it, you know, you can do something as simple as wear a rain jacket. And what that does is that keeps the wind off your back, and then you have a better chance of staying warm.
Let's say you have to be outside when the temperature is 10 or 15 below, like the Monday and even the Tuesday forecast. Are there issues that you should be aware of even if you're dressed for the conditions? Let's say you don't have any exposed skin. Does your body just not function as well in that kind of cold weather?
No, in fact, your body will function fine but you have to pay special attention to maintaining your body. So do all the things that we talked about of keeping your extremities warm, keep your core warm. Make sure you're adequately hydrated, so don't go out dehydrated. If you're diabetic, don't do that work on those cold days because your nerves and your feet and legs don't work properly, so you're not going to recognize frostbite. And if you're on medicines for hypertension or heart problems, don't go out in the cold. Pick a different day to do that work. If you can keep those things in mind and pay special attention, you actually can perform and function fine in the cold weather.
What kind of gearing up does an emergency department have to do for a cold snap like this, if any?
This is mostly standard usual care for us. I mean, we know we've had a cold weather snap, so we expect individuals to come in with frostbite. Most of those individuals have made bad decisions about alcohol and have been out in the snow and didn't take the signal to their body that they needed to get into warm air. Occasionally, you might have somebody who's in a snowmobile accident and they're stuck outside at a time until they can get either found or picked up. But this is sort of our standard bread and butter practice this time of year.
I imagine something you would expect if you're practicing emergency medicine in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Indeed.
Chris Decker, thank you so much. Stay warm.
Okay. All right, Mitch.
Dr. Chris Decker is Emergency Department Medical Director at Froedtert Hospital in the Medical College of Wisconsin. He joined us by phone. The extreme cold is also a danger to buildings, bridges, and ships on Lake Michigan. We'll examine the sometimes overlooked field of cold weather engineering when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we heard about the very real and very significant impact that extremely cold temperatures can have on human beings. But the cold has an impact on man-made structures, too. Buildings, bridges, and ships on Lake Michigan all face perils when it comes to temperatures as low as the ones we're experiencing this week. Charles Ryerson has studied how cold and ice affect superstructures. He's with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire, and he joins us on the line. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
What are the key reasons that you study cold and ice? Why is this a subject of scientific interest?
Well, of course, the polar regions are almost continuously cold. You heard on the news about the research ship this last week that was frozen in the ice in the Antarctic. But, of course, the majority of us on the planet in the mid-latitudes and farther poleward experience winter. And winter, we all live with and tolerate, but it has its costs. in its hazards, in its use of energy, in its effect on human health, and an effect on the economics of how we do things. And so it has a very high cost, and as I say, we tolerate it because it's something we have to live with. And surprisingly, there's not more done with it than is research-wise than there is, frankly.
Well, and so we hear a lot about engineering in, say, hurricane or earthquake-prone areas. But let's talk about the particular engineering challenges in a place like Milwaukee or another northern kind of city in which there's a frequent freeze-thaw cycle, and it can get down to 10 below or 20 below or even colder than that. What are the engineering challenges to structures like buildings or bridges or other large man-made objects?
Well, initially, of course, the foundations have to be built to withstand soil freeze-thaw on heaving of the soil and migration of moisture, which forms frost lenses, which those of you in the northern latitudes, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, we had this problem. Potholes forming in roads where water migrates up because of the freezing and forms a lens, and of course it expands and breaks the pavement away. So the first thing you have to deal with is a foundation. And then, of course, once the structure is built, hopefully on an appropriate foundation, then you have problems of icing and snow formation on power lines, for example, on tall towers, tall buildings. For example, the new 1776 tower that was built in New York had quite a bit of there was quite a bit of concern about ice formation on that structure and it falling to the pavement and being a hazard to people. So structures accumulate ice, for example, from either freezing rain or snow, from rime ice, or sometimes even from snow that you'll get freeze-thaw cycles, as you mentioned earlier, and water will run down into a crotch, let's say, where two structural members come together. It'll form a chunk of ice that may be the size of a baseball. And if that falls then 500 feet to the ground and it weighs a pound or two, it can be lethal, actually.
Is there anything that you can do to engineer a building or a bridge to keep that ice from forming or to mitigate how it falls?
Actually, design can be a fairly significant way to deal with ice, but it all depends on the kind of ice that's going to form. If you have ice that forms from freezing rain or snow, it's pretty difficult because freezing rain or snow will land on and stick to just about anything. If you have in-cloud icing, so let's say you have a fog that forms and you have tiny cloud droplets that are 20 microns in diameter, then airflow causes them to either strike an object and freeze and cause ice to grow into the wind, or the droplets will pass around it. And as it, this seems counterintuitive, but larger diameter objects ice less than smaller diameter objects because water droplets in clouds or fog will tend to flow around larger diameter objects, but they'll tend to collide with smaller diameter objects and freeze.
So we've heard about these ships in the Antarctic region trapped in the ice, which is obviously a consistent problem in that part of the world. But how do bodies of water like the Great Lakes ice up in comparison to sea ice? And what are the unique problems that icing on the Great Lakes might cause to ships and other structures on the lake?
Well, any, we'll call it a seagoing vehicle or a vehicle that's out in the ocean. So now we're talking about offshore platforms in the oil industry or ships will ice if spray is created either by waves or by, in the case of a ship, its bow plunging into the seas. So in the ocean, we have salt water, and the typical salinity of salt water is about 33 parts per thousand, fairly high, high enough that the freezing point is depressed by a couple of degrees Fahrenheit. And when the water lands on the vessel, in particular, the large amounts of water that land on a ship, the water will freeze. But water doesn't freeze with salt in it. So what happens is that the water freezes, it excludes the salt and causes it to be concentrated in what we call brine pockets. And those brine pockets weaken the ice.
But this is why people, you know, use salt to break up ice on the roads, for example.
That's right. But in the Great Lakes, we have fresh water. And freshwater ice freezes, of course, at 32 Fahrenheit, and it doesn't have salt in it. And as a result, it forms clear ice, and it's much harder and much more tenacious in the sense that its adhesion strength to substrates, to decks, to railings, to whatever on a ship is much, much stronger. So when the Coast Guard goes out with their small icebreakers and tries to either do search and rescue or create passages for ships, they experience superstructure icing. Now, they don't experience it when they're breaking ice. The floating ice suppresses the waves and you don't get any spray. But if they're in transit, let's say between Sheboygan, Cross Lake, Michigan, when they're in the open lake, the spray will form on the ship. The bow generates spray, then that passes up over the ship. And it can be sufficient to cause so much weight and such an increase in the height of the center of gravity of the ship that it'll founder, it'll roll over and sink. Fortunately, we haven't lost a Coast Guard cutter that way, I don't think, since the Second World War, and that was in the Atlantic. But fishing trawlers are lost every year. I don't know what the current statistics are, but those that watch reality television have seen crabbing boats certainly ice up, and the technology we use to de-ice them today is what we've used for the last several hundred years, probably, and that's mallets and things like baseball bats.
Well, and so this brings us back to our initial question about the key reasons you study cold and ice. Is this an issue that people are taking on, better ways to de-ice a freshwater ship?
To de-ice any ship, freshwater or saltwater, is a significant problem. And right now it's being looked at pretty carefully because the Arctic Ocean is opening up. And as the Arctic Ocean opens up, there'll probably be more activity up there, commercial activity, tour boats, maybe military activity, we don't know. As a result, the Coast Guard is going to have a much more active presence, at least off the north coast of Alaska. And they'll be pushing the envelope in the sense of the edges of the season. In the late fall, early winter are the most dangerous times up there for superstructure icing, as we call it. And so the goal is to try to develop better ways to either prevent icing on ships and offshore platforms or to remove it without having to send people out on deck with baseball bats or whatever and to break it off. Because now you have people out in the elements on a rolling ship on an icy deck swinging mallets, and it's a pretty serious thing to have to ask people to do in those conditions. The problem with icing is that most of the times it doesn't sink ships, but it is a safety hazard to the ship because the anchoring hardware is frozen in, navigation aids are frozen in, sometimes the radars become frozen, antennas ice over and they can't communicate effectively. And so most of the time, it's a hazard, we'll call it a safety hazard, rather than a threat to life, but it can easily become a threat to life.
As someone who studies cold weather and icing for a living, does a cold snap like the one that's happening across the northern half of the U.S., do you look at it in the sense of, well, this is going to provide me more data in the future?
The tragic part of our discipline is that when serious conditions happen and power lines fall and ships sink and airplanes crash, then there's renewed interest in the problem, and there's renewed interest in trying to solve those problems. So, no, we do not wish these things to happen, but unfortunately, tragedy does happen, and so we tend to be a society that responds to problems after they've happened, and so that's how the research happens. it would be wonderful to be able to go out and collect data every time these storms occur, and occasionally we can do that, but the resources aren't typically available to take advantage of that.
Well, Charles Ryerson, thanks so much for helping shed some light on this issue for us.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Nice to talk to you.
Charles Ryerson is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire, where we reached him by phone. Lake Effect essayist Mark Segrist learned a thing or two about icing when he took his own man-made structure out in the cold.
Mother Nature was displaying a split personality, sunny yet frigid, just above zero. The ice scraper was useless. A few stabs of the windshield was the best I could do. The rest of my ride was covered in road salt. The old Cavalier was a mess. This called for action. So I set sail for the neighborhood car wash. The closer I got, the more I questioned my judgment. Would the doors freeze up, locking me out for the rest of my morning errands? Maybe. But if the place is open and other fools before me are taking the risk, what's the worst that could happen? I felt much safer when I realized I had sufficient company. That is, until the attendant took my $4 and mumbled something while heading back to her position. With my filthy, frozen car in neutral, locked in place and about to be dragged through a tunnel of water, I yelled back, asking her to clarify. "I'm sorry, what did you say?" "You're entering at your own risk," she pleasantly responded. I suddenly felt a slight tug on the car to signal the start of my journey. As my window was closing, I heard her complete the legal warning in a more muffled tone with the words, "Because it's so cold outside." My mind started racing, and with it, my atrial fibrillation. "Godspeed, John Glenn," I thought to myself. "I'm headed for the final frontier, a mechanical frozen tundra." I checked my seatbelt, my cell phone, anticipating what's next. A shattered windshield, perhaps? Would a high-pressure sprayer or vacuum be my ultimate fate? How embarrassing to be rescued from a mangled conveyor by the jaws of life. Finally, I break through the storm clouds and see daylight at the end of the tunnel. Is this heaven? No, it's South 27th Street in all its commercial glory. Civilization, at last. I survived, with a good wind from the dryers at my back and some errands to keep. Well, at least once I get the driver's side door to open again. She was right. Because it's so cold outside.
Mark Segrist is a freelance television producer in Milwaukee whose work appears on Milwaukee Public Television, among other outlets. His children's book, Smoochy Dog Earns a Badge, has just been published as well. Another break now, and then we'll meet the Greendale native starring in the national tour of Ghost, the musical. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Anyone who was dating anyone in the early 1990s probably found themselves in a movie theater with Patrick Swayze, Demi Moore, Whoopi Goldberg, and of course, Unchained Melody. The movie Ghost grossed over $505 million at the box office and is still on untold millions of Netflix queues. And most recently, it spawned a musical version, which played Broadway and is now on a national tour. Ghost, the musical, has a limited run in Chicago later this week. One of the stars is a Greendale native. Katie Bostotnick plays the lead role of Molly in the musical. She stopped by the Lake Effect studio while she was in town for Christmas, and she told Bonnie North how she got on the musical theater path.
I went to Greendale High School, and I kind of decided during high school I wanted to pursue a career in musical theater. That's what I wanted to do.
Had you sung?
Yeah, I had done shows with my family growing up, you know, just for fun. We did like community theater in the Milwaukee area. And then I, you know, did all the musicals in high school. And I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. So I went to Oklahoma City University and studied musical theater there. And then in March of like 2010, I moved to New York and started auditioning. And I got lucky, you know. This is my second national tour. I was in Rock of Ages as Regina like 2 years ago. And I was on that tour for a year. And now I'm touring as Molly in Ghost, the musical. So very exciting.
It's like the dream of every kid who wants to, you know, be big in show business is to go to New York and to hit it.
Yeah.
And to make it happen. And it happened quite fast for you.
Yeah, it did. Which is, I'm lucky. I'm lucky that, you know, I had lots of people helping me, supporting me. I went to college, really helped me. And my family and friends are great.
So for you as a performer, mm-hmm. what are some of the things that you really, other than the actual singing, of course, that you needed to focus on to be able to be hired, to be the one that people kind of go to and say, yeah, you know, we
Yeah, won't. I think it's difficult. You know, they're not just looking for a voice. It's not just about can you sing. Everyone can sing. You know, it's if you give a good energy in the room, if you're a positive person, if they know you work well with other people. Like once you start working and you have a reputation, and you know you have to make sure that's positive, that people think of you positively and like to work with you, and you know, and you, do you look right? So much of it is out of your control, and it just kind of depends on if what that person making the decisions that day thinks, you know, and if you have the right look that day, you know.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest things about the business is that there is so much that's out of your control.
Yeah, I think it's important to like not let the rejection outside of the business get to you. You kind of have to control what you can control and do your job as an auditioner. And then if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't, you know.
Yeah. So when you're not touring, are you taking classes to keep
your
skills
always.
Up?
Always. It's so important to always take classes and always, you know, like there's cabarets you can do in the city or to keep yourself doing something creative in the meantime. Try to get involved in like, I did some readings of new musicals. Stuff like that is great, you know.
So for somebody who's looking to do what you did, what are the things you need to do to get to the point where you're ready to audition? Do you need to be able to read music? Do you need to be able to dance, you know,
yeah,
act,
I think
all
it's
of
for,
those things?
It's different for every person, but I think it's important to push yourself to be able to do as much as you can, because the more things you can do, the more boxes you can be put in, and you know, the more possibilities. So if you push yourself to dance, if you're just a dancer, push yourself to sing, push yourself to play an instrument, push yourself to act, you know. If you're more of a singer, you know, you have to do it all kind of now, and they expect you to,
right,
you know?
The triple quadruple threats.
Yeah, even like playing instruments now and dancing, and right. You know, they're doing a revival of cabaret. You gotta do it all. So you never know, and I think it's important, yeah, just to push yourself to work hard and be able to do as much as you can.
Do you find that there are as many tours going out? I mean, are you able to make a living doing this?
Oh, yeah, totally. There's lots of tours going out, and there's lots of opportunities. Yes, I think there is definitely you can make a living. I mean, you're not – I wouldn't say, like, go into musical theater to become rich and famous, you know, but it's if it's something you love, like, and I think the other thing is that opportunities are endless. There's so many other things you can do. Like if you move to like New York, you're auditioning for commercials, TV, all that kind of stuff.
And, have you done that?
Some, but you know, like nothing has landed yet there, but you never know. Like I think keeping your options open is good. So.
Right. Yeah. For this show, Ghost, mm-hmm. It's such an iconic film.
Yeah.
What is it like to bring it to stage and to play that part?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's hard because people have this idea of Demi Moore in their head, and you know, I don't have the little pixie cut. I have a blonde wig. So like people are like, oh, she doesn't look like her. So I have that obstacle sometimes to go around. I'm like, well, it's not my fault. But I think that it's interesting because I don't want to be Demi Moore. It's my adaptation of the role. But a lot of the scenes from the musical are similar to the the movie. The writer of the screenplay, Bruce Joel Rubin, wrote the book for the musical. So literally, sometimes scenes that you know and love are like plucked from the movie and placed in the musical, and then like a line from the movie has been turned into an entire song. And the music is fantastic too. Dave Stewart and Glenn Ballard wrote the music, and it's a pop rock kind of score. And I think they did a fantastic job. So
that pop rock thing seems to be the way of musicals now.
Yeah, it is.
So you need to be able to sing in that style as well.
Yeah, I like singing in that style. It's fun.
Yeah. How is it being back in the Midwest and being close to home?
Yeah, it's fun. It's really great to be able to tour with the show and be able to come home and be like all these people I did theater growing up with are able to come see me in the show, and my friends and family. The support is so great. People are coming down to Chicago, and then we're also up in Appleton in March, which is just fantastic.
So not quite Milwaukee, but close. It's within a drive. I guess probably closer. Well, is it closer to Chicago? No, about the same.
About the same. Yeah.
So in either direction. Yeah.
Yeah.
So well, that's good though. Yeah. And how long is this tour?
The tour is for a year, so till next September, and they could possibly extend it. So it's a long. It's a nice job for a while.
It is.
It's gonna be great.
How do you keep it fresh? That's a long time to be doing the same.
Oh,
part.
Totally. Yeah. You know, I think. As a performer, you just always have to challenge yourself to be present at work every day. You know, you just have to be there in the moment every day and be reliving those scenes every day on stage and remembering that the audience members are there. Some people seeing that show for the first time every day, and you want to give them as good a show as you did, you know, when you first started. So I think just always reminding yourself of that every show and every day, you know, that it's not about you. It's about who you're telling this story to.
Well, also, I would think it would help that you're in a different theater every couple
every,
of weeks.
Yeah, every so week. Yeah, every week or 2 weeks, we're in a different theater. But you know, the set travels with us. Our crew is fantastic. We travel with the crew, and we have tons of trucks. And our set is massive. We have these two huge video screen walls that move up and down, and they have doors that open, and they kind of make some of the set pieces and these big loft walls and. They do a fabulous job. It's a really tech-heavy show, and it's incredible what they can do. They set our stage every day, but they try to make it backstage the same as much as they can, so we're not, like, totally thrown off every
city. Where's my prop?
Yeah.
Where's the, where's this? So, where's that? Yeah. So that helps, you know. Well, but again, it depends on the theater you're in, too,
right.
You know, because sometimes there's more space.
Yeah, the sound is definitely different.
The sound is always different. I wouldn't envy the sound guys trying to balance everything what you're doing. So are you auditioning or thinking about things ahead? I know you've got, like, almost a year to go on this, but are you having to think that far ahead?
You know, I'm not auditioning or anything because I have this job and I want to stay in this job. But I think it's always good when you have a job to keep yourself in the business. I'm still, like, learning new music and, like, thinking of shows I would like to be considered for or, you know, always keeping myself fresh and reading what's happening. And I've, like, gone back to visit a couple times, so... Yeah.
Okay. So,
definitely.
Keeping your hand in there,
even though
you're working.
On the road. I think, you don't want to get, like, too comfortable in a job.
Because it's going to end at some point.
Yeah.
At some point. Well, Katie, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your holiday time to come and talk to us and, break a leg.
Thank you.
It's fantastic to have you back.
Thanks.
And best of luck in the future.
You too.
Katie Pastotnick plays the role of Molly in Ghost, the musical, which opens tomorrow night at Chicago's Oriental Theater and runs through January 19th. If you miss it there, you can catch the same production on stage in Appleton in April. She spoke with Bonnie North. A conversation with a woman just named the National Ambassador to Children's Literature is when Lake Effect returns on WUWN. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The Library of Congress last week announced that writer Kate DiCamillo has been named the country's National Ambassador of Young People's Literature. DiCamillo is a name that millions of kids are familiar with, from younger children who enjoy the Bink and Golly series of picture books she co-authors to older kids who devour books such as Because of Winn-Dixie and The Tale of Despereaux. DiCamillo joined us in the studio back in 2012. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why do you write for kids?
Okay, here's the long answer. I knew that I wanted to be a writer for a long time. I finally started writing, and where I started was where most people start, which is short stories, thinking they are shorter, therefore they are easier, which of course is completely erroneous. And right around the same time as I started writing, I moved to Minneapolis from Central Florida, and I got a job in a book distributor, and I was assigned to the third floor, which was all kids' books. And my job was a picker, which is just as dignified as it sounds. So I went around literally, you know, picking the books off the shelves and filling orders. And as a reader, there's only a certain amount of time you can go with pulling a book off of a shelf without starting to read it. And so I started to read my way through the third floor children's literature. And one of the first books that I read, a novel written for kids since I had been a kid, was The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963 by Christopher Paul Curtis. And I thought, I want to try to do something like that. So that's the long answer of why I write for kids, because I ended up on the third floor of the Bookman.
And you still remember the first one you dug your way through?
Right. Right. And what I did was, we were allowed to check books out there. We could, you know. And so I took The Watsons Go to Birmingham. I took it home and I typed up like a chapter of it to get a feel for how long a chapter would be and, you know, what it was like typeset as opposed to manuscript, so I could get an idea of how long a middle grade novel would be. And then I tried to write one myself.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, so how long did the transition take before you felt like, this is a vehicle I can handle?
Well, you know, the thing is, in retrospect, it all sounds like I knew what I was doing and that I had a plan, and I didn't. Instead, it was more like I was so moved and admiring of that book and was starting to read other books like Katherine Patterson's Bridge to Terabithia. And I thought, I don't think I thought, oh, I'm going to try a middle grade novel, but I was very, very interested in it. And then I heard one night before I went to sleep, I heard this little girl's voice say, I have a dog named Winn-Dixie, in this southern voice. And I had been working on a short story. And the next morning when I got up, I put that aside and I started with that sentence. And that turned into Winn-Dixie. And so I already had the template for how long it should be, how long the chapters it should be, based on Christopher Paul Curtis's novel.
Is there any extra pressure on children's authors?
Yes, whatever the answer is, there's extra pressure. I feel extra pressure all the time. Okay, I'll let you finish. Okay.
But, I mean, if you're writing for adults and they don't like a book, you could say, well, all right, well, they're going to pick up the next book, or they're going to read my next book. But with kids, maybe there's the risk that if they don't like your book, okay, well, maybe they figure reading isn't their thing.
Wow, what a burden to put on me, man. So it's just like what you're saying is, if they don't like my book, they're not going to like to read. So
maybe that wasn't it.
No,
I think that's unfair. But
this is the pressure that I feel, and it's actually a pressure that I like, because you have no time to waste when you're telling a story to a child. They will toss it aside. So you can't enter in a leisurely way or a self-indulgent way. You're telling a story, and you have to tell it. And I like that pressure of keeping them engaged. It keeps me engaged as a writer too.
And thank you for gracefully answering the question that I should have asked.
Oh, I gave you a little bit of grief beforehand. So, but I know what you're trying to ask.
I think that's kind of what you answered, the idea that it's about grabbing them.
Right. Absolutely. Adult readers will be more patient. But the other difference, I think, in writing for children as opposed to adults is a Katherine Patterson quote that I can never remember, so I can only paraphrase it, about when you write for children, you're duty bound to end the story with hope. And I love that dictum too. And it changes me as a writer.
There is a difference between a hopeful ending and a happy ending.
Absolutely. It's a very subtle difference. But the hope as opposed to happy, and I almost always end on hope. I don't know that I always end on unhappy.
Do you think when you get it right, when everything goes right, like you've written the book like The Magician's Elephant, your young readers physically get it, and then they get it, they like it, or they connect with it, does their world change a little?
I would sure love to think so. I would hope that that's true for kid readers and adult readers. I think that's what story does for all of us, is it shifts how we look at the world. It's what it does for me as a reader.
I mean, there's this feeling that I get that in a certain way you are the sum total of all the things you've read over the course of your life. And when you're a young person, that number isn't quite as large.
No, it's not. And it opens – I mean, even, you know, as adults too, it's forever opening doors in your mind and doors in your heart. But I think it's even a more profound effect when you're a kid.
And it sure beats the heck out of, you know, having it all be cereal boxes that you've read, I guess.
Although I liked a good cereal box when I was a kid. I would even read, you know, a Cracker Box. I wasn't particular. I was just like one of those kids who I had to have something in front of me to read.
Do you feel as a writer, is there a different comfort level for you and the different styles that you work in? Books like Magician's Elephant and The Tale of Despero are in places that you've entirely created, where a book like Winn-Dixie is grounded in a very real place. Do you feel like you have a different sort of creative freedom when you dream a place up?
I don't ever feel like I have any freedom, because I'm so terrified when I'm doing it that I'm going to drop the ball somehow. And when I'm in the quote-unquote real world, like Winn-Dixie is and Tiger Rising is, I don't feel any more constrained by that than I do by an imagined world. So always the trick for me is just getting out of my own way and letting the story do what it's supposed to do. So it's not – I don't feel more freedom one way or the other. It's just – me getting out of my own way.
What about sense of time? Winn-Dixie feels like it's in the somewhat recent past, and Despero and Magician's Elephant are in the more distant past. Is there something important, though, about writing a children's book that isn't linked to a very specific point in the present time, I guess that is?
I feel like kids' books can last for a long time, and I don't consciously pick a time that is, although I did do that in The Magician's Elephant, there's, I think the phrase is at the beginning of the end of the century before last, which I don't even know what that means, but it sounded right and it got me somewhere in a distant past. And so then you don't have to worry about texting, emails, cell phones, all that kind of stuff. And cell phone sure takes a lot of drama out of what can happen in a book, because you say, call home. I was watching Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with a 9-year-old friend, and he's like, this is really good, but I don't understand why they just didn't call somebody on their phones. And it's like, well, they didn't have cell phones. And he's like, oh my God. Yeah. So the talk about freedom, it gives you freedom to be in a time before all of that technology, because it lets conflict build more.
Well, yeah. And I also wonder that, you know, not that you necessarily want to talk about books having shelf life, but you know, when you have younger readers, they pass through the middle grade fiction much faster than than, you know, passing through science fiction, or you know, you have a moving target for your audience.
Right. So, and I'm not writing with an eye toward shelf life, but I am writing with an eye toward story, and that's the ultimate goal always. And I think it's easier to tell a story sometimes in a different time period.
We talked about the idea of the comfort level in each of these kind of styles, but I wonder, is there also a different creative itch that gets scratched when you're writing something like a Bengali book versus any of the other kinds of books that you write? I mean, do you have a feeling when you work on something like this, okay, I'm writing for younger kids now, I get to be a little silly?
Well, I'm always a little silly. That's always there. Sometimes it's masked by language, but that silliness is always there. Bengali, I would have to say the creative pull there is the thing of, you know, I wrote those with Allison McGee, and writing for me is so terrifying that to be in a room with somebody else is enormously comforting, because then I think, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'll just assume that she does. You know, so there's two of us there. And so that's the artistic pool there. Those are nothing but dialogue, those books. So and I love doing dialogue. And so it's just a rapid fire back and forth, and every bit of character is revealed through the dialogue and then through, of course, Tony's fabulous art. So
how does the creative process work for a book like this? I mean, when the two of you are in a room, I mean, are you—
– We were literally, you know, we would— – it was—
– Are you Bink and she's Golly? Or?
I'm Bink for sure. I feel very Bink-like, and Allison is very tall and I am very short. But we didn't say, okay, you be Bink and I'll be Golly. What we said was, let's just do something together, and it's just— – I don't know how to collaborate on something. And so I went over to her house and we sat in her office, and I sat there for like 10 minutes and I said, right, see, this isn't going to work. And I got up to go, and she's like, sit back down. So we sat there and just kicked stuff back and forth until we had three stories. And it was really a great deal of fun and not as terrifying as writing normally is for me. And then they go off to the brilliant Tony.
Well, and so how much guidance does he have? I mean, is he really just working from your dialogue, or do you have thoughts for—
– We had some thoughts. You know, we had the Bank is short and Golly is tall. We think that they live kind of like— – there are no adults in their lives, and they kind of live in a tree with Bank more to the ground and Golly up, you know, high. And I think that we said that. And then he doesn't work, you know, with us. He works with the art director. So we gave those little clues. And then his first art came back. And for me, it's like looking at myself on the page.
Yeah, I mean, it must be a little bizarre to send this out into the world and then have it come back and look like something.
Right, right. And Tony, I was at a convention with him last summer, and I said, I can't believe how you captured me when you'd never met me. And there was this long pause, and he said, well, there are pictures of you on the internet. It's like, oh yeah, yeah. So I love what he did. I think it's brilliant.
What do you think you have learned from your audience?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Oh, from my audience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Since you first said, okay, I'm going to write Winn-Dixie, what has the audience taught you? Because you
what
do
have
any
the, yeah. What have the kids taught me?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I wrote Winn-Dixie, and I had been working in a book warehouse, so I had a very realistic expectation of what would happen with a middle grade novel, which is that if I was lucky, 5,000 copies would sell, and I could maybe earn out my advance, and I would maybe be able to do another one. So what happened with Winn-Dixie kind of like defied all of my expectations. So I had this wonderful situation where I had readers, and then you want to please those readers, which means they liked Winn-Dixie, so write another book like Winn-Dixie. What I learned was that if I can get out of my own way and tell a story, it doesn't matter what kind of story it is, those readers, those kids will respond to it. And so it's a well-told story is what matters.
Do you imagine your books on a shelf someplace and the picker is going around and grabbing them?
When I worked at the warehouse, there was a guy named Gary who would meet me every day at the time clock and say to me, what's plan B, babe, for when the writing doesn't work out? What's plan B? And for a long time, I used to wake up in the morning and think, Gary is somewhere moving around a pallet of my books. And that made me so happy. Of course, the Bookman has now gone out of business. So I don't know what Gary's doing anymore. That's an amazing concept, really, because I only thought about it in terms of the Bookman before. But there's a book distributor somewhere and somebody's picking that book, and maybe somebody will read Winn-Dixie and think, oh, I want to try to do that. That would be great.
And if all goes wrong, you always have picking.
I don't, because they went out of business. Yeah. And you're right. But that's it as far as the skills go. Yeah. It is.
What a weird way for me to end this.
Well, tell me what else I can do. I can work in a bookstore. That's it. Yeah. So I like to end on the note of if all goes wrong.
How many projects do you have going at any one time?
What I usually do is I have two and I bounce back and forth between them. So like right now I've got a novel, and then there's something else that's a shorter thing that I'm working with my editor on doing rewrites. So when one thing feels impossible, I can work on the other thing.
Well, Kate DiCamillo, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
writer Kate DiCamillo in a Lake Effect interview from 2012. DiCamillo is author of books such as Because of Winn-Dixie and The Tale of Despereaux. Last week, she was named the new National Ambassador to Young People's Literature by the Library of Congress. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Stay warm as best as you can. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.